From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Did you kill somebody?
I don't know.
The Netflix series Orange is the New Black left viewers hanging when it wrapped up its first season, showing Piper Chapman responding to a death threat from fellow inmate Pensatucky by beating her bloody. Today we'll hear the interviews Terry recorded with Piper Kerman, whose memoir about serving time in a women's prison inspired the series, and with Jenji Kohan, who created Orange is the New Black, as well as the Showtime series Weeds. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews season 2 of Orange is the New Black, which picks up where season 1 left off.
Maybe you're right. I don't want to fight you. I want to end you right now.
All 13 episodes of Season 2 are now available for streaming on Netflix. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Fault in Our Stars. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, Netflix is unveiling the entire second season of its most popular original production, the Women in Prison series called Orange is the New Black. It stars Taylor Schilling as Piper, an upper-middle-class woman in prison for a drug trafficking crime she committed a decade earlier. On today's show, we feature interviews with Piper Kerman, who wrote the memoir the series is based on, and series creator Jenji Kohan, who also created the Showtime series Weeds. First, though, we check in with our TV critic David Biancooley, who reminds us where the show left off and tells us the new season begins with a strong but very unsettling start.
Last summer, Orange is the New Black premiered the same way it's returning for season two this summer. Beginning today, Netflix is making all 13 episodes of the season available for instant consumption. Six of those episodes were made available for critics to preview, but even the first episode of season two is plenty to remind viewers why Orange is the New Black has gotten so much attention and acclaim. Last season ended with a holiday episode, as the female prisoners put on a Christmas pageant at their prison. But the festivities didn't stay festive. Piper was threatened with death by unhinged fellow inmate Pensatucky and responded by exploding both mentally and physically. As the new season begins, about a month after that brutal beatdown, we don't know whether Pensatucky is dead or alive, and neither does Piper. In fact, when Piper is roused in the middle of the night and transported out of the prison after a month in isolation, she doesn't even know where she's going next. But on the way, with a chance to talk to the prisoner seated next to her, she finally uncorks all her pent-up emotions. Taylor Schilling plays Piper.
I did something kind of bad, and I was doing my time for it. And then I did this, other thing. And I think maybe I'm going away for it for a long time.
What? Did you kill somebody?
I don't know. I mean, this girl, she was coming after me and she was not gonna stop. And she is, or was, she was relentless. I mean, just crazy. So crazy. And I completely lost it. I just went there and I didn't really know that there was a bear there. But I don't know if it just grew there recently or if it's always been there, but that dark place, that place that let me just keep hitting her and hitting her and hitting her. I couldn't stop.
It's a great scene, powerful, gripping, and totally out of the blue. Taylor Schilling carries this opening hour as Piper goes on her unexpected detour with character-illuminating flashbacks to match. But we all know Piper will be returning to the familiar cell block and all her fellow prisoners sooner or later. And thanks to Netflix, later can be as soon as you want, because you can start episode 2 seconds after you finish episode 1. Orange is the New Black is being entered in the comedy category at the Emmys this year, which is kind of outrageous. Some scenes are as intense as those in any drama series. Even so, its large ensemble cast is equally adept at scenes that make you laugh out loud and scenes that make you lean forward in anticipation. As a TV viewing experience, however quickly or slowly you devour it, Orange is the New Black is captivating.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview Terry Gross recorded with Piper Kerman, whose memoir Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison, is the basis of the Netflix series. First, let's hear an excerpt of the interview Terry recorded with series creator Jenji Kohan. They spoke last year after the first season of Orange is the New Black was released. Here's a clip from the very first episode. Newly arrived inmate Piper Chapman, played by Taylor Schilling, is eating one of her first prison meals with several other inmates. An inmate named Red, played by Kate Mulgrew, walks over and gives each woman, except Piper, a container of yogurt. Red speaks first.
Who's this?
This is Chapman. She's new. Self-surrender. I think she's fancy.
Here. Fancy. Have a yogurt.
What do I have to do for it?
You're new. You're one of us. Consider it a gift.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The food here is disgusting. What?
Did I mention that Red runs the kitchen?
I'm sorry.
Honey. I know you just got here, so you don't know what's what. But I'm gonna tell you. You don't like the food? It's no problem.
Holy, that was an epic.
So this is your second series about a middle-class woman who ends up doing something criminal. In Weeds, she's dealing marijuana, and in this, the main character has carried drug money, a suitcase of drug money, and years later is busted for it, and that's why she's in prison. So what interests you about the middle-class woman who has an element of criminality in her life? It's not violent criminality, but it is mm-hmm. breaking the law.
I think...
And they're both connected with drugs.
Yeah, particularly for this project, in a lot of ways, Piper was my Trojan horse. You're not going to go into a network and sell a show on really fascinating tales of Black women and Latina women and old women and criminals. But if you take this white girl, this sort of fish out of water, and you follow her in, you can then expand your world and tell all those other stories. But it's a hard sell to just go in and try to sell those stories initially. The Girl Next Door, The Cool Blonde, is a very easy access point, and it's relatable for a lot of audiences and a lot of, you know, networks looking for a certain demographic. It's useful.
One of the things I really like about Orange is the New Black is the casting, the actresses. The series is an opportunity to showcase the talents of a lot of Black and Latino actresses who don't seem to get a lot of roles, at least not prominent ones. Was that one of the reasons why you wanted to do the series in the first place?
The wealth of talent in this pool has been remarkable. Like Crazy Eyes, who's one of the real breakout characters on the show. I think it might be number 50 on the call sheet, and she's a star. They're all stars, and they're dazzling, and they're enthusiastic, and they adore one another. And when their scenes are done, they stick around and watch other people do their scenes, and they hang out on the weekends. And it's kind of been a love fest on set, which I'm so grateful for. And part of that I attribute to one of our producers, Lisa Vinicor, who moved to New York to do the show for me. And she's kind of den mother and works with all these women and plans activities. You know, they all walk across the Brooklyn Bridge and go for pizza, or they all go salsa dancing. And she's really created an environment where these actresses are supporting one another and doing such a high level of work.
You mentioned the character Crazy Eyes, who's played by the actress Uzo Aduba.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the character for people who haven't seen the series.
So Crazy Eyes has a lot of mental issues, and prison has become a dumping ground in a lot of ways for the mentally ill as the safety net kind of melts away. And we wanted to talk about that. But we also just loved this woman who finds herself attracted to Piper and loves her so deeply and acts out so inappropriately and can't really process her feelings and her behavior very well. And yet there's something so vulnerable and poetic about her.
Why don't we hear a scene with her and Piper? So this is Uzo Aduba as Crazy Eyes, and Piper is played by Taylor Schilling.
Hello, baby. Look at you getting your sweat on. You look how shiny. I bet you don't even smell funky. Oh, I knew you wouldn't. You a real woman, Chapman, a real grown woman. And not like all these other girls around here. I can't waste my time with these silly bitches. I need a real woman.
I'm sure that you'll find one.
I wrote a poem, you wanna hear?
You know, that's fine.
Before I met you, the sun was like a yellow grape. But now it looked like fire in the sky. Why? Because you light a fire inside me. I wrote it for you.
You know, my fiance is a writer.
I'm gonna call you Dandelion. Because they're pretty and yellow just like you.
So that's a scene from Orange is the New Black with the series star Taylor Schilling as Piper Chapman and Uzo Aduba as Crazy Eyes. How did you find her, Uzo Aduba?
Uzo tried out for another part. I think it might have been Tasty. I'm not sure. But I fell in love with her through this audition. I didn't think she was right for the part she'd auditioned for. And I told Jen, you know, I'm going to use this actress. Tell her she has a job. I don't know what it is yet, but she's in.
Jenji Kohan speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation later in the show. Coming up after a short break, Piper Kerman, whose 13 months in jail and subsequent memoir are the basis of the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Netflix has released the second season of its acclaimed original series Orange is the New Black, based on the memoir of the same name by Piper Kerman about the year she spent in a minimum security women's prison. Kerman was a 24-year-old graduate of Smith College in 1993 when she flew to Belgium with a suitcase of money intended for a West African drug lord. That misguided adventure caught up with her 5 years later when she was named part of a drug conspiracy ring. In 2004, she reported to the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. Kerman is now a communications consultant working with foundations and nonprofits and serves on the board of the Women's Prison Association. She told Terry that when she entered prison, it was easy to mess up. There was a lot to learn.
First of all, you have to learn and understand all of the rules of the institution, all the rules that are enforced by the guards and by the wardens. And those include things like, you know, the daily counts when every single person within a unit is counted. And there's a host of rules, both reasonable and unreasonable. And what's confusing about that is that they are selectively enforced and frequently broken by the prison staff themselves. The other set of rules that you have to learn very, very quickly are the unofficial rules. And so that could be anything from not taking someone's habitual seat at the movie night. You don't want to sit in the wrong place because, you know, you will be pretty quickly corrected on that. To, you know, not asking someone directly what their offense is because that's considered very, very rude. You have to figure all those things out. And what you really have to figure out is where you fit in the social ecology of the prison.
And well, where did you fit in? Because you, I don't know what the racial makeup of your unit was, but mm-hmm. you're a white, middle class, maybe upper middle class, you know, woman who went to like Smith College. You're very mm-hmm. educated. So I don't know if you were totally atypical within the prison population or not.
Trying to figure out where you fit in isn't necessarily all about your class and your race. It's very much about you as an individual. And what do you have actually to contribute to this community? Where will you fit in? Where will you put your energy and your time?
What did you figure out you had to contribute?
Well, you know, I immediately was assigned to work as an electrician. I had hoped to be a teacher.
Like your character in the Netflix series. And
yes, that is...
It's not really up her alley in terms of her particular skills.
I had requested and hoped to be assigned to the GED program and to teach, but I was not. I was assigned to the electric shop.
That makes no sense. I mean, you're obviously so educated. I'm guessing here that you were probably an English major. You probably could have really helped in the GED program. Why would they sign you, who probably has no electrical aptitude, to that program?
The description is always institutional need. The prison system is very arbitrary and not necessarily always very sensible. So I can't necessarily offer a lot of insight on the assignment. Other than that, they needed somebody, they needed a warm body in the electrical shop. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Because I worked in construction and maintenance services, I was able to fix things for folks. I put up hooks. I fixed people's beds, you know. When I insulted the woman who ran the kitchen, I really did need to make amends to her in some ways. She was not starving me out in the way that the character on the TV show is punished. But, you know, she was not feeling a lot of love for me. But it turns out that her bed was really, really giving her pain. And I managed to rig her bed up so that it was less painful for her to sleep at night. And for that, she sort of allowed me back into her good graces.
In your book, before you go into prison, your lawyer tells you don't make any friends inside. And in the Netflix series, one of the prison officials gives that same advice to the character who's based on you. He says, don't make any friends inside. Did you think you should take that advice seriously, and did you?
I probably thought that I should take that advice seriously, but I certainly did not. And frankly, I don't know how you would survive prison without forming friendships. It seems impossibly lonely, isolating, dangerous even to try to survive prison without friendships.
So what do you think the warning was about? Was the warning really about, like, there's lesbians there, be careful? Or was the warning like, if you make friends, you will be deceived, it will just be a way of using you?
I think that the warning for me was you will meet people in prison who are from completely different walks of life for you, and if you leave prison with those friendships in place, those friendships will be problematic for you. And I don't agree with that, but I intuit that that is what that advice was about.
In the Netflix series, the woman who had been your lover back in your college and post-college days, who got you into the trouble that you got into, she's the one who asked you to carry the briefcase of drug money. In the Netflix series, she's in the same prison you are, in the same unit. It wasn't that way in real life, was it?
It happens in a very different way in real life and in the book than it does in the show. But, you know, in truth, I ended up sharing a cell with my ex-lover.
Sharing a cell with her?
Yes, and her sister. You know, her sister was also there. Her sister was also involved and spent a lot of time in prison.
Well, that seems so impossible to me. Like, if that was written into fiction, I'd say, oh, come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, truth is much stranger than fiction when it comes to the criminal justice system.
What kind of terms were you on with each other then? Were you blaming her for the fact that you had been implicated in this, you know, quote, drug conspiracy? You know, for telling on you, did you?
Actually, I am one of the things that I am most grateful for is the fact that the strange, you know, happenstance of the universe brought me face to face with her during that time, because I was really holding on to a lot of blame, actually, in terms of saying, oh, you know, this, I'm here because of her, and actually being able to confront her. Brought me to the point of recognition that my situation was my own responsibility and my own fault. She offered me a quote-unquote opportunity, but I chose to take it. You know, she didn't hold a gun to my head. She didn't make me do anything. She asked me, and I said yes. And so I think that if I had not been brought face-to-face with her, I would never have gotten quite to that point of taking full responsibility for my own actions.
Did you become close again?
One of the things which is really astonishing and humbling to me is the fact that ultimately the things that you have in common with somebody are much more important than the things that are potentially dividing you. And so we were brought face to face in very, very difficult circumstances towards the end of my experience in prison. And because we were able to confront each other in terms of, you know, hey, what am I doing here? What are you doing here? And sort of move beyond that, you know, I was able to get to a place where we were able to be friendly again. And I'm grateful for that.
Piper Kerman spoke last year with Terry Gross. Her memoir, Orange is the New Black, is the basis of the Netflix series. Its second season was released today. We'll hear more from series creator Jenji Kohan in the second half of today's show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from W.W. Norton, publisher of Flash Boys by Michael Lewis. A group of idealists takes on a high-tech Wall Street predator. Available now. From Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And from Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Fault in Our Stars, adapted from John Green's best-selling young adult novel about two teens with cancer. And more with Jenji Kohan. She'll tell Terry about breaking into the business of writing for television. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. The second season of the acclaimed Netflix series Orange is the New Black is now available for streaming. We're going to hear more of Terry's interview with Jenji Kohan, the creator of the series, which is set in a women's prison. The series is based on a memoir by Piper Kerman, a Smith College graduate who did federal time at a prison in Danbury, Connecticut. Jenji Kohan also created the Showtime series Weeds. Terry spoke to her last year when the first season of Orange is the New Black was released.
Now, I have to ask you, of course, about the main character, Taylor Schilling, who plays Piper.
Right.
She's obviously got the most prominent role. Casting her was key.
Yes, it was so huge.
What was the casting process like?
It was arduous and big and long, and it was difficult because, you know, I had a picture in my mind, certainly based on the real Piper and also just as I was writing, of this waspy, cool Shiksa who ends up in this situation. And, you know, it can get shallow because, oh, she looks like that, but...
Wait. I'm going to stop here. Would you say that to Piper Kerman, whose book this is based on, whose story this is based on, saying...
That Piper's a waspy,
you,
cool Shiksa?
Yeah, I wanted to cast a waspy Shiksa. Thank you for writing your book.
Yes, exactly. I think at this point, Piper and I are close enough that we can joke around like that. But there's another thing I talk about with Piper herself a lot is that Piper Chapman isn't Piper Kerman.
Right.
Piper Chapman is her own character with her own journey. It started with Piper Kerman and it became its own animal. It really did. I think to all our relief, because I can't imagine how horrible it would be to sit and watch a weird version of your life coming back at you week after week. And when I was writing this, you know, as I said, I was talking about the Trojan horse aspect of this character, and you need to go in with the girl next door, that every girl, that unlikely Seven Sisters grad who ends up in women's prison. And I had a physical type in mind because I'm shallow. And, you know, a lot of different women came in, and what was really special about Taylor, what is really special about Taylor is she's a hot girl who's also funny, which is not a common occurrence. And she's got depth. And there's so much more to her than the surface. And there's just a richness there.
There's a really big cast. I didn't count, but there's like, I don't know, some like 12, 15 regulars on the show. And you want us to know all of their backstories, which is a really tricky thing to do. So, you know, basically every episode has one or two backstories in it. And right. So we slowly get to find out why each of the women in prison is there, what their lives outside were like, what's the crime that they committed. And it usually puts that character in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come up with that as a structure to tell the stories of multiple people?
Right. Well, in terms of the flashback device, you know, when you're writing a show, this is your life. And I did not want to spend all my days in prison. It seemed really oppressive and potentially depressing. And I wanted to build in a structure where I could get out and these people could get out and we could have some blue skies, wear some actual clothes as opposed to uniforms. And the bonus of that was you get to see a fuller picture of who these people are, because everyone wears a mask to a certain extent in prison. You take on a persona to survive. And there's more to these people than just what they're displaying in this extreme situation. So what started out as, gee, I really just don't want to write scenes in the same set all the time, became a way to flesh out these people a lot more.
Let me talk about another character who's in it, and this is the character of Sophia. And Sophia is a transsexual, male to female. And when Sophia, in her earlier life, was a male, she was a firefighter. Mm-hmm. And tell us about the person who you've cast in the role.
So Laverne Cox is a transgender woman and, you know, came in and took it. But one of the greatest miracles of Orange is we seem to bring in the people we need at the time. And there are little miracles that occur all the time. And our Christmas miracle with Laverne was we wanted to do a flashback episode in which she was still a man. And Laverne's a woman and she has breasts and she doesn't have body hair and she... You know, it would have been very, very difficult to show her as a man. And it just so happens that she's an identical twin. How does that happen? I don't know. Things like that seem to happen on this show. And
Her brother came in and did a great job, and we have this one scene where he goes down to rinse his face in the sink, and then she comes up in prison, and it's the same face, but it's the male and the female, and it was extraordinarily lucky.
Did you have any idea when you cast her that you'd be able to do that?
No, and in fact, it was a joke, because we'd already been talking about stories we wanted to do, and we knew we wanted to do a Sophia flashback episode, and we were joking, God, okay, we need a transgender who's a really good actress and is also an identical twin, ha, ha, ha. And we found it. It was remarkable.
Well, let's hear one of her early scenes. And in this scene, the main character, Piper, played by Taylor Schilling, has gone into the bathroom, and there's no stall. I mean, there's no door on the stall, so that's making her really uncomfortable. And Sophia, played by Laverne Cox, who we've just been talking about, is in the bathroom too, and she's trying to put Piper at ease and trying to show her the ropes. So they talk about the fact that Piper is still wearing the shower shoes that she was given because she hasn't gotten her commissary money yet. And so here's the scene.
Your commissary ain't come in yet?
Oh, I think so. My ID number doesn't shop until tomorrow.
You better hope they got what you need. They ain't had powder foundation in dark for 3 months. Can't be walking around here with white face on. With those sad pair of shower shoes, I'm not gonna save you. You need some of these. I made my own. Couture. Commissary don't carry a size 13.
Is that duct tape?
Metallics are very in this season. Don't hold your big bathroom too long. Prison food stops you right up. You gotta get it out while you can. If you wanna skip that shower line, do the 5 a.m. or the 5 p.m. That's my secret.
Why are you telling me all of this?
Because I up your hair. That looks broke. When your commissary comes in, swing by the salon. I'll fix it right up for you.
Thank you.
There's no point in playing shy, baby. You're home.
That's a scene from Orange is the New Black. My guest, Jenji Cohen, is the creator of the series. How did you put out the casting call? Like, when you're looking for, you know, so many different main characters, do you just call the agents or what?
Yeah, no, a breakdown goes out, and we're looking for, you know, Latina woman, early 20s, black woman, ghetto, middle-aged Russian, you know, whatever it is. And you get a whole bunch of people. When Jen goes through casting and sends all the auditions, there's a range, and there are different interpretations of the role. And sometimes it's exactly what it was in your head, and sometimes someone comes in and brings a whole other color to it that you hadn't thought of, and you suddenly realize, oh my God, that's it. That was the right way to go.
If you put out a casting call that says black woman ghetto, isn't that just the kind of casting call that really annoys a lot of African-American actresses?
I'm sure. But, you know, you're not going to write a novel on a breakdown. You have to use a few words and see who comes in, and hopefully they have enough faith in us. Or they don't, but they want the work, and you figure it out.
Orange is the New Black is on Netflix. Did you want to go to Netflix? Who approached who? Did you approach Netflix? Did they approach you to do something?
No, you know, I made the rounds. You always want to pitch.
You made the rounds with Orange?
I did. I took it to HBO and Showtime and Netflix, and the greatest thing about going to Netflix was I pitched it in the room, and they ordered 13 episodes without a pilot. And that's miraculous. That is every showrunner's dream, to just go to series and have that sort of faith put in your work. They paid full freight. They were new. They were streamlined. They were lovely. They were enthusiastic about it. And I love being on the new frontier. I love being first out of the gate. It's really, really fun, because I think it is the future in a lot of ways of how people consume media. And it's great to be in there early.
Jenji Cohen created the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. Its second season is now available for streaming. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview recorded last year with Jenji Kohan, who created the series Orange is the New Black. All 13 episodes of the second season are now available on Netflix.
You are the showrunner of Orange is the New Black. Explain what that is.
Wow, okay. you know, I run the writer's room. I have final cut in the editing room. I approve all the casting, wardrobe, sets. I'm the big tease, I guess, on this show. This is my baby, but I'd like to think I'm a benevolent dictator, and that one of my great skills is hiring people who are really good at their jobs and for the most part letting them do them.
Yes, and you have said in previous interviews that writing for the Tracy Ullman show taught you how to run a healthy show where people were good at what they do and were kind to each other. And I read that and I thought, as opposed to what did you experience that wasn't that way?
You know, there is this cycle of abuse in a lot of writers' rooms and productions, and it doesn't have to be that way. And when you're spending upwards of, you know, up to 15 hours a day with people, I think it's really important to have a no asshole policy and surround yourself with people who are really good at what they do, but are also pleasant to be around. Particularly in a writer's room, if there's a predatory person in there, or someone who's going to attack everyone else when they open their mouths, you're not going to get the best out of people. You have to create a safe space. Not to say that all writers aren't smart asses and if you throw the ball, they're going to hit it. You know, these are the people I spend my time with, and I don't want to be with nasty, unpleasant people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jenji Kohan, and she's the creator and showrunner of Orange is the New Black on Netflix. Your father, Buzz Kohan, was or is in television.
Mm-hmm.
Is. So I went on IMDb, and he wrote for a lot of Oscar broadcasts and other specials. So did he write, like, the quips or the straightforward, you know, for the best movie, compelling drama?
Yeah. He wrote musical numbers. He wrote jokes. He was a machine. He is a machine. He's a very funny man. He was the king of variety television in his day. You know, every Christmas special, holiday special, Motown 25, the Oscars, all those things.
Motown 25, that's the one where Michael Jackson did Billie Jean.
Yeah. He used to write the tours for the Jackson 5, the patter on the tours.
No,
he had
really?
An amazing career. Yes, he's a remarkable guy, he set a very high bar. But we were very separate from that. We were not, you know, he went to his office and he sat in his underwear and typed with two fingers and came home late and said hello.
His office at home?
No, separate. He had a little apartment that he wrote out of.
Oh, but he wasn't in, like, some office high-rise in his underwear.
You know, if he'd been in a high-rise, he might have been in his underwear there, too. Comfort first. He had this remarkable career, and he's won, it's like, 13 Emmys, and very prolific, very funny, very gifted, and a craftsman as well. And my mother is a writer as well. She's a novelist. And I think a lot of my ear for dialogue actually comes from her. But we were very sheltered from it, and we were not supposed to go into the business at all. We were supposed to be doctors and lawyers, or I was supposed to marry well. but I think when you see that this career is possible, it doesn't become this amorphous, you know, goal. It's like, oh, I could always go into showbiz because that's a real career, because that's what was modeled for me and, you know, my brothers.
Why did you want to go into the business, knowing that your parents preferred that you not?
I didn't necessarily. You know, I got out of school and I was working a lot of odd jobs, and I was dating someone whose friend was having success in television. And he kept talking about his friend, Dave. And I had written a lot of shorts. When I was broke in college, I'd enter fiction contests, and I'd often win and get a little cash. And I thought, oh, I can write. I want to try this. So my ex-boyfriend said, you have a better chance of being elected to Congress than getting on the staff of a television show, which was the perfect thing for him to say because, you know, my entire career is, you know, well, screw you. And we broke up and then I started writing. One of my close friends was studying for her medical boards and I quit all my crappy odd jobs and I moved in with her. She was living in Santa Cruz and every day we'd go to these little cafes in Santa Cruz and I would work on spec scripts and study these videotapes I'd recorded off television of Roseanne and Seinfeld and Simpsons and I'd write my specs and she'd study for her boards. And when I was done, I came back to Los Angeles and my parents said, you know, we're not going to help you. This is not our thing. And what ended up happening was my sister-in-law's father worked in a building with an agent and gave him my scripts in an elevator. And he read them and I was on a show by spring. So it took off from there and I never stopped working.
Was that Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
That was Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Was that a fun show to write before?
No, it was a really fun set. The cast was lovely. The writer's room was wildly dysfunctional, and I was the only girl. And it was a time in L.A., you know, around the riots and Farrakhan rallies. I got my nickname, you know, White Devil Jew Bitch, which, you know, I hold dear. And it was a rough entrance to the business, but I was in.
Has being a woman made your rise in television any more challenging, do you think, than it would have been?
It's hard to say. I've always worked, and I think I have a talent for it, and whenever things didn't work out, I wrote something new and I wrote something new and I kept plugging. I was often the only girl in the room, which is hard. You know, they talk about how few women there are in the business, whatever. But, you know, it's because we don't have a farm team. You know, there's not a lot of women being developed. You're one in this sea of men. But I've also been really blessed. You know, I've worked pretty steadily for 20 years so or more, 23 years. But I think a lot of that is just I'm not very good at taking no for an answer. And if you don't like this, how about that or that or that? I keep buying lottery tickets.
In the days when you were in a writer's room and you were the only woman in it, did you have to ever say, no, that's like really incredibly sexist or stereotyped. You just can't say that. You can't give that dialogue or that plot twist.
No, it was never about gender particularly. It was just you can't say that because that's lame or untrue or but in terms of being offensive, that's a line I cross often. So I never pull that punch. But I'm not there to be cop, to be gender police. And what offends me more than something sexist is something poorly written or unfunny or cliched.
Jenji Cohen, congratulations on the success of the series, and thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jenji Cohen speaking with Terry Gross, recorded last year. Cohen created the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. Its second season is now available for streaming. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Fault in Our Stars. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The film adaptation of John Green's best-selling young adult novel, The Fault in Our Stars, is among the year's most eagerly awaited movies. The love story about two teens with cancer stars Shailene Woodley and Ansel Elgort. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
I know people who cried at the trailer of the romantic teen cancer movie The Fault in Our Stars. At the movie, they'll need a life preserver to keep from drowning in a flood of tears. Me, I didn't cry, though at times my tear ducts tingled. I was on the verge. The film is a little slick for my taste, too engineered. But it's gently directed by Josh Boone and beautifully acted. Whatever the faults, it's not in the stars. Shailene Woodley plays 16-year-old Hazel Grace Lancaster, whose life was saved by an experimental drug, but who remains in stage 4 cancer. She has to cart around an oxygen tank connected with a tube to her nose. Hazel is a nihilist. She projects her terminal illness onto the world. She says humankind will eventually perish, and no one will remember Mozart, let alone someone like her. Enter handsome high school ex-basketball star Augustus Waters, played by Ansel Elgort, who lost part of a leg to cancer but is now in remission. Augustus falls for Hazel on sight. He literally gawps at her at a teen cancer support group and goes on in his witty, winsome way to argue against her worldview. The film, like John Green's novel, is a debate on the subject of what's the point? Oblivion, says Augustus, is not a design for living or dying. I found Augustus too good to be true. But hey, it's a young adult romance. A little wish fulfillment is just what the doctor ordered. The character did test my patience in his first scene with Hazel, when he sticks a cigarette in his mouth.
Let's go watch a movie.
Okay. I'm free later this week.
No, I mean now.
You could be an axe murderer.
There's always that possibility. Come on, Hazel Grace, take a risk.
I don't... Really? That is disgusting.
What?
What, do you think that that's cool or something? You just ruined this whole thing.
The whole thing?
Yes, this whole thing.
Oh, man.
Even though you had freaking cancer, you're willing to give money to a corporation for the chance to acquire even more cancer? Let me just tell you that not being able to breathe sucks.
Hazel Grace, they don't actually hurt you unless you light them.
Hmm?
I never lit one. It's a metaphor, see? You put the thing that does the killing right between your teeth, but you never give it the power to kill you. A metaphor.
The constant association between tobacco and death is a good thing for teens to see, though I still think Augustus looks too glamorous waving that cancer stick around. In any case, Hazel is plainly smitten, but tells Augustus she wants to stay just friends. She doesn't want to die and break his heart, even if he says it would be a privilege to have his heart broken by her. To elevate The Fault in Our Stars to the level of myth, the film sends the couple on a trip to Amsterdam, an odyssey to meet the reclusive author of a novel Hazel loves about a girl with cancer, a novel that cuts off in mid-sentence at the moment of the character's death. Hazel needs to know what happens to the surviving characters, an obvious extension of her need to know what will happen to her loved ones in a world without her in it. The subplot offers a welcome change of scene and gives Willem Dafoe a good part as the author, who turns out to be a mean boozehound. That said, it's a mite tacky when Hazel and Augustus are moved, finally, to a climactic clinch in that most aphrodisiacal of settings, the attic of the Anne Frank house. Whatever reservations I have about the film, I've none about Shailene Woodley, a young actress without a smidgen of actorishness. Her pale skin is near translucent. You read her emotions in her coloring. She's believable as the daughter of the wonderful, emotionally overflowing Laura Dern, whose squiggly mouth opens even wider than usual. I don't think I'm spoiling anything when I say the central question, will anything in their lives endure, is answered hopefully. Love such as Hazel and Augustus's is likened in the movie to mathematics, where between two fixed points there can be, well, a kind of infinity. That's an unexpectedly high-flown idea. Even a cynic like me can respect it. The title, of course, is from Julius Caesar, from Cassius's Exhortation to Action. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Here, though, the fault does seem to be in the stars, in an unjust universe. What else to blame for kids getting terminal cancer? But as Hazel and Augustus prove, we never have to be underlings.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Myers directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from William Morrow, publisher of Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner's Think Like a Freak, about how to apply the principles of Freakonomics to solve problems. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
If I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you.
On the next Fresh Air, Shep Gordon talks about his life as a Hollywood insider. After a chance encounter with Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, he became the manager for Alice Cooper, Blondie, and Pink Floyd. He's influenced countless stars and is the subject of a new documentary by Mike Myers, who also joins us.